accession number 20966, Reel 5.
Carpasucci, Reel 5.
Because a passport was used as a carrot and a reward to those who were deserving communists. In 1947, when the communist government took over, foreign travel became virtually unavailable to normal citizens in the country. So yes, there was Zionism. Many of my friends went to Israel, still there today. But after 1947, you would not want to declare that you belong to a Zionist organization. That was regarded as anti-state activity.
Did you personally have any contact with the West during the communist period?
My contact continued to be the BBC, which again was all right to listen to in 1945-46, but not after the communist regime. Had to be done clandestinely, and it was again punishable. And other than that, there was no contact. I don't remember any direct contact with the Western world at all.
What was
Yes, the radio, the wireless, because you would be listening to music from the Western world and to Hungarian news. The Voice of America became active after the war, and the BBC continued to do a great job.
In what sense?
That's why I am here. Because I didn't know much about France, I didn't know much about Sweden or Switzerland, I knew enough. But I could not imagine anywhere else my life in the West than in the United Kingdom, because the BBC made it so attractive. Mother of all democracies, the tolerance in the country, the attitude in general to refugees and to immigrants. And so it was the obvious choice in 1956. And we have been thinking of leaving the country. The main reason being is that I don't think we would ever had any children under the communist regime, where children were brainwashed or educated to be informers on their parents, to tell what goes on at home, what the parents do, what they think, and turn against the parents if the atmosphere was not properly communist. And we could not imagine bringing up children in those circumstances. And we wanted to have children.
Did the BBC take a propaganda line about England?
That's a very difficult question you are asking, because I would have to think what propaganda, what it means, propaganda. To me, propaganda must be transgressing the truth, but I never had the feeling in those days that the BBC was telling me things that were not true. They might have told me things colored a bit pinker than they really were. But it never occurred to me that I will come to this country and I will be greatly disappointed, because I will find that the BBC was telling me lies about life in this country. So I didn't think that the BBC took a line of propaganda, although it must have been very carefully worded and presented.
Did you ever come across any resistance to the regime under the communists?
Only passive resistance, which I myself as an individual practiced, as I told you before. I was becoming very naive when political discussions took place. But I remember, for example, that you could not escape certain things, like I was still at university, so this is 1947 to 51, and it must have been in 50 or 51, certainly not in the 40s, when there was a movement announced by the government that you had to offer 1 month wages or whatever to the state to buy bonds to support the fight against imperialism or whatever. And of course, as students, we had no income, but we were told that one Sunday every month we had to go around the area near the university with a party member, and we were given addresses, and we had to visit the people on those in those addresses and persuade them to buy bonds. And we were even told for what amount of money they had to do that, because they virtually knew everybody's earnings. Mostly these people were pensioners that we were assigned to go to visit. And I had some terrible Sundays where I had to persuade people clearly in terrible conditions. I mean, I went into their flats and spent time in their homes. And I had to do the talking, and the party member was there to watch me and watch the homeowners. And if there were one or two who resisted, and I couldn't persuade them, I was told off and even threatened that I might not be able to finish my university studies if I am not more successful next time.
Was life under the communist regime uniform, or did it vary from time to time, in the sense of as the years went on?
I lived about 8 or 9 years under the communist regime, from 47 to 56, when I left the country. From 1947 until 1953-54, the situation got gradually worse and worse and worse. I would say that the darkest years of the communist regime were in 1953, where when you would fear the doorbell ringing, because you, especially if it was early in the morning, because you thought that they were coming to fetch you. It was at that time when Some of our friends were sort of deported from Budapest to the provinces because they had some, they have committed some social sins, like they were the owners, capitalist owners of factories, and that was undesirable. There were times when they were unveiling imperialist agents who had no more, no greater sin than be the son of a factory owner who didn't come back from the concentration camp or from wherever. People lived in fear more and more and more. In 53 is really the darkest year when many deportations took place, many arrests took place. Even when you came out of a cinema seeing a Russian, a Soviet film, and saying to your partner that was rubbish, you would have a tap on your shoulder and you would go in for questioning. And sometimes you disappeared. There are even anecdotes of the time, like there is a meeting. Very often there is a they organize meetings after working hours to discuss and air problems that people had in their lives. And on one of these occasions, every occasion there was a person sent centrally, a central person who talked about some aspect of life or politics or economics of the country, and then they elicited questions and comments from the audience, from the floor, and there was such an occasion, and nobody was responding. Because people were afraid of exposing themselves. Eventually, they persuaded Uncle Istvan, and he said, "Well, I have a question. Very often, we get pork in the canteen and pork in the butchers, but we only get the trotters and the ears and the head. Where are the other parts? What happens to the other parts of the pig?" "Okay, that's a very important question. We shall look into that next time. We'll tell you about it." Everybody knows in the country that it went to the Soviet Union as an export or whatever. Next time the meeting comes, 4 weeks later, and again, the talk is over, and they say, "Anybody, any questions?" Silence. Long period of persuasion. In the end, somebody says, "Uncle John, Uncle Janosz, what is your question?" "Oh, I have only one question. What happened to Uncle Istvan since the last meeting?" Nobody sees Uncle Istvan anymore. Anyway, that was people, the country lived in fear, that's for certain. And so there was a gradual deterioration of freedom, of thought and expression. And then, for some reason, difficult to say, in 1954-55, especially 55, liberalization took place. And in 56, the writers, mainly the writers of the country, began to expressing views and questioning political decisions and dogma in words and then in writing. And really, that's how, in 1956, during perhaps a period of 6 months, the revolution gathered pace in Hungary. So your question, was the life uniform? In some respects, it was. That they have established certain patterns which they kept to, but the oppression, political oppression, and freedom of expression, political oppression increased and freedom of expression decreased from 47 to 53, and then 53-54 it stayed, and then there was a gradual liberation of restrictions, and at that time there was more contact with the Western world. We even had Western visitors, mainly artists, who came to perform in the country. But it was very gradual. So in that respect, there was a deepened and a liberation going on.
Can you remember if there was any reaction to the death of Stalin?
Yes, indeed, there was a relief, but nobody knew what it would mean. Everybody was anxious about who will take over from him. And nobody thought that there will be a change in the direction in which the communist regime will progress, politically or economically. That was the immediate reaction. And later on, I think that brought in some changes in the isolationist ideas that the Soviet regime had. And there was some kind of a lifting of restrictions. But I couldn't comment any more on that aspect at the time.
Can you take me through the events of 56 as they affected you, please?
Yes. It was a mysterious experience to be able to read criticisms of the government. It was like in fairyland, and there was an idealistic atmosphere in the air, and there was no sense of evil or in ill will at all. Everything was absolutely ideal, and the spirit was rising and blossoming. The interesting thing was that when the first riots came, everybody was very enthusiastic, as far as I can remember, and watching the events. Not many people, I don't know of anybody who took part in the riots. I haven't met anybody, not in our circles. But there was a time when you could not go out anymore, because there was street fighting, and it wasn't secure to go out. And that was perhaps a week after the events at the radio station. And it was at that time when my best friend, whom I mentioned to you, came to us, we were all sort of locked ourselves up in the house and not moving out, said to me that it was wise of you not to go out because there was shooting and disorder in the house. But now I would suggest that you keep really very low, because the revolution is turning nasty towards the Jews. So please stay at home. That was October, wasn't it? October the 23rd. So November, we were warned that some nasty elements in the revolution took advantage and took revenge. Not necessarily revenge, but they blamed again many Jews for the communist regime, partly because some Jews exposed themselves in the administration, but also because of the continued tradition of anti-Semitism in the country. We were warned not to go out. Now, gradually, the situation became just like in war in Budapest. We were in Újpest, and my wife and I became very anxious to find out what was happening to her parents. And Agnes's parents lived in the center of Budapest town, which was about 10 kilometers from where we lived in Újpest. And we decided one evening that we just have to walk up there and find out what was going on. And that was, I tell you the exact date, virtually, 23rd of November, we went there, and my father-in-law, well, we found them all right, and my father-in-law said to us, I am able to arrange for you to get to the border at Sopron, which is a westernmost town in Hungary, near Vienna, and if you want to, and there we have, then if you want, you can attempt to cross the border. At that time, we knew that the border was open. All the mines were cleared, exploded. In some places, the barbed wire was also cleared, but in many places, the barbed wire was still there. And we said we think about it. So we slept there. We didn't go back to Újpest. And next morning, Agnes's aunt, Agnes's mother's sister, came. And we don't know how she brought and why she thought that she might find us there. They lived in Buda, on the other side of the river. So she had to walk about 8 kilometers. And she brought a letter from her husband to a friend and a doctor colleague who was living in Sopron, introducing us to him and telling him to help us to get across the border if they can. Sopron is about 5 kilometers, no, less than that, from the border, the Austrian border. So I had to make a decision, it was left to me, whether we shall take this opportunity or not. And I've decided yes. We didn't even go back to my parents to say goodbye or tell them what we were planning to do. We got into that lorry, where we were covered up with wrapping paper, brown wrapping paper. And that took us to the border, which is what, about 200 kilometers from Budapest or thereabout. We were stopped by patrols, a couple of Soviet patrols in the country on the way, and a couple of Hungarian patrols. And we were lucky because at one time they were pushing bayonets through the paper, but they didn't. They missed us. We got to Sopron late at night, and we found in Sopron there was curfew, and it was after curfew, so we were risking our lives, but we managed to find the address. They read the letter and they took us in. Lovely people. And they said they know, because he was a doctor and he had a white clientele, and he had some farmers, patients. They said they know somebody who is due to come in 2 days' time, had an appointment, and they might find somebody to take us across the border. Well, he himself eventually took us across the border, but as we were, and we had a small suitcase of change shirt and socks and pants and these sort of things, and we were about to leave, and he said it's about 4 to 5 hour walk into Austria, and he knew the way. Some of his relatives were living on the other side of the border, as it is usually the case in border areas. And as we were about to leave, a family appeared, a couple about our age, not quite 2-year-old toddler, and a 75-year-old half-blind grandmother. And they wanted to join us to get across the border. And so we started up. We left our suitcase there because we had to take the baby's suitcase. Oh, and the mother was pregnant, about 6 months pregnant. And we started out. About an hour into the walk, the snow started to fall. And the guide became very anxious that our tracks will be left in the snow. Also, the toddler was given an injection to make him sleep so that he was quiet and no problem on the road. He woke up and started screaming about a couple of hours into the walk. So the guide became very anxious, and he said to me, "Where is that rum you promised me?" So I gave him the bottle of rum, which he started swigging. He had to change the route because we were near a watchtower, and he wanted to take a detour so that the child, the screaming child, would not be heard. Eventually, 5 hours later, we arrived at a point where we saw a little light somewhere at a distance. It was very difficult to judge because it was snowing, it was dark. He said, "You take that road, go across, and that is Austria." And I am turning back, I am not going any longer. So we gave him the money that we had. By that time, the bottle of rum was gone. We started walking, and suddenly we found ourselves in the minefield, which was or craters because the mine were exploded. Then we came to the barbed wire, which was still there. Somehow we climbed over, which was quite a wide area. It was, if you